Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 83, recorded August 19th, 2010. Cat fur speaker cones. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Carbonite Pro. With prices starting at $10 a month, all of your office PCs can be backed up safely and automatically. For a free trial and to learn more, visit CarbonitePro.com. It's This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm Ryan Shrout, joined once again by Patrick Norton. Patrick, where exactly are you located today?
I'm in beautiful Lakeview, Oregon. And I think it's a place called the Fremont Inn. In any case, I'm up here for some training, a class that takes place in up on a hill with rocks and stuff. In Oregon, southeastern Oregon. I'm like closer to Reno than I am to San Francisco right now.
So now, I guess I shouldn't say it like that. I say, where is Patrick today? When in reality, I was gone last week, actually. Mm-hmm. I was en route. I was in Dallas, Texas. Couldn't get away from set up for the workshop and all that kind of stuff. Had a lot of fun there. We were at QuakeCon 2010.
Dude, I know you and Robert. You were in the middle of the hella gigantic freaking death match with all of your friends.
Yes.
Can't get away. I'm setting up for my demo.
yeah, all that stuff. Right, exactly. You know, you're in a room, essentially one giant room with 2,500 other gamers. It's a pretty cool event. If people have listened to this haven't ever been to a LAN party, and I don't mean, you know, you and four or five of your buddies setting up in another guy's basement or something like that. Those are still useful. Those are still fun. I still encourage those. But it's, you know, you go to something like a PDX LAN, which is up in Portland, QuakeCon in Dallas. They're all over the country. You can get anywhere from, you know, 500 up to like this one, 2,500 up to 2,800 people could have fit in this convention center in downtown Dallas, Texas. It's pretty interesting. They also had the exhibitor area. So you had guys like Asus and NVIDIA and AMD and Sapphire and Antec and Patriot and all these guys set up booths. And it's interesting for them because they're not used to necessarily going after the consumers or talking to the consumers face to face. You know, their target audience, obviously they know there's going to be some media there.
Your fan is like totally too loud on my graphics card. Can you fix it while I'm here?
Yeah, I bet they actually got a lot of that, which I'm sure they absolutely adored. But you know, it's good for them to kind of get what do these 2,500 gamers in there? What hardware are they actually using? What problems do they actually have with their computers? We're guilty of this on this show as well. We tend to talk about, you know, the $1,200 graphics cards and the, you know, $800 solid state drives and that type of thing. And walking around the BYOC, not a lot of people are using those as you would expect. We did this little thing with Western Digital where they gave us a dozen hard drives, some Velociraptors and some 2 terabyte Caviar Black drives or 1 terabyte Caviar Black drives. And we kind of walked around. And we made an announcement. It's like, if you think you have the crappiest storage system in all of QuakeCon, come find these guys. Maybe they'll have a new hard drive for you. And there were some really, really bad. Guys running off 60 gig parallel ATA.
Knew it was going to be. I was going to say, was the smallest one a 60 gigabyte drive? Because for a while, every cheap machine had a 60 gigabyte drive. Those things were just
talking about
everywhere.
like the thin Mac store drives where they're a little bit thinner than normal for whatever reason. 60 gigs, parallel ATA, IDE. I mean, it was like, wow, I feel, yeah, here, you need a hard drive. You need to, here, take this right away type of thing.
Now you just need to buy a new motherboard so you can talk to this hard drive.
Yeah, sorry about that. I got you this brand new, you know, $150 hard drive or $300 hard drive if you were lucky enough to get a Velociraptor. Now I just upgrade the rest of your system so you can install it. All right, have fun. See you later. Like that, but But it was interesting to go around and see what people are actually gaming on. And there were some uber awesome machines, highly case modded systems that had liquid cooling on everything and 9 hard drives, this and overclocked to 4 gigahertz, that and that type of thing. Saw a couple of quad SLI systems. I mean, there's still a lot of people that go all out on this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Also saw somebody brought in a 52-inch TV to use as their monitor.
Really?
Which I thought was kind of funny. Yeah.
52-inch. How did they get it in and out in one piece?
Do you carry it up? You have a friend carry the TV into the BYOC with you, and it was one of those 52-inch Samsung LEDs, so it was thin and light type of thing. It was a really nice TV. It's like, okay. He said last year he brought like a 42-inch TV, and somebody had one bigger than him, and he didn't like that. So this year he upgraded.
It all became crystal clear. This is a non-rational gaming decision.
Or very huge, considering how close you have to sit to the monitors at these events. So it was fun. We'll talk a little bit about kind of what we saw there. Actually, you know, we'll go ahead and get into that now, because one of the other things they had at QuakeCon was a discussion with John Carmack. I know you talked a little bit about this last week. Talked about seeing Rage running on an iPhone. 60
glorious frames per second. So it's being rendered in the cloud and then sent to the phone?
No, this is all being rendered on the phone, but it is different code. It's very different code than what will run on your PC or the Xbox 360 or the PlayStation 3, but it is using the same assets. So there's basically an export tool that they built in the Rage engine that will allow them to export level data, terrain, characters, all this kind of stuff into an iPhone ready format. So obviously smaller sizes, a little bit less compute intensive and that kind of thing. But the actual application itself is using custom code that accesses all that. I mean, that would be a lot to ask, but it did look very good. Again, we didn't see a whole lot of interactivity. You know, he's moving around the level and all that kind of stuff, but no shooting people, no interacting with bad guys or anything yet. It's still pretty early in the project, but they did say they were going to have something on the iPhone when the application launched in September of 2011. So just over a year from now. So we'll have to see how comparable they are. I don't expect them to be too great.
Just there enough was time something... for Steve. Oops, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Don't worry about it.
You mentioned the cloud on there, and what was interesting that he said about the cloud was we talk about the cloud computing, all this kind of stuff. Right. But there was something he mentioned about ray tracing, and what happened was, long story short, is they needed more resources for the development of Rage to speed up the development of Rage, and they use giant server clusters to kind of render things offline and send them to their developers and their artists and all that kind of thing so they can see how things look. Well, they had hit a bottleneck on performance. John, being one of the lead guys there, is like, oh, no problem. We'll just go down to the IT center here in the building and we'll throw in, you know, 60 new servers or whatever and get the job done. Until he went down there and they said, yeah, we're really at our thermal and power limit for this building on what we can install. And he was like, I thought it was funny because even he was like, you know, I never even thought about it. We always just thought, well, that, and we hit this wall where we couldn't do it in our building anymore. It was going to be, you know, a 6 or 7 figure project to upgrade power and get the air conditioning system changed in this office building they've been in for, you know, 2 decades. So, you know, something like that. And never really had to run into that problem before. So then he started looking at the cloud stuff. He's like, well, how can I get Amazon EC2 to render all of our stuff and send it down? And he said they got that to work and all that was fine. But what was more interesting was that he had changed his mind on what he thought about ray tracing in general. He really thinks now that in a couple of generations of hardware that we might actually see ray tracing start to overtake traditional rasterized graphics for standard PC gamers, which is something that as of like 18 months or 2 years ago when I interviewed him, he kind of expressly said he didn't think it would ever happen. He said they'll always make advancements on rasterization. Ray tracing will always be heavier and more realistic, but much harder to run on any given system. And he said, nah, and after playing with it for a while, he might have changed his mind. So kind of interesting.
Get it out of the way, the Intel McAfee thing.
You want to go ahead and jump into that? That is kind of the big story of the day,
Sorry, your voice faded. Perhaps my connection from here at Lakeview is finally dying off, but the it's Intel buys McAfee. Intel, mostly the chip people, buys McAfee, who we think of as a security software. And there's some interesting angles on this. GigaOm pointed out that from a financial standpoint, McAfee made 80% profit on $2 billion in revenue last year. Why do you care about this? Because you're a computer hardware person. You probably don't care about the revenues of McAfee. What you do care about is whether or not Intel is purchasing McAfee to integrate more security into the chip, the processor itself. So you're not relying on the operating system. You're not relying on applications running on an operating system, but making fundamental changes in the architecture of the chip to promote security or to integrate security technology, which apparently is going to be the big thing in the corporate and or government world in the future. Or maybe it won't be, because, you know, things like this tend to sort of fade in and fade out of importance based on whether or not someone can actually ship a product on time. But you were saying this represents an actual pretty significant investment for Intel.
Yeah, so they purchased it for $7.6 billion, mm-hmm. which is a ton of money. And from what I read on one of these stories, that's about 60% of Intel's kind of standing wow. cash on hand. Right, so they are making. I mean, look, if that's 60%, that means they still have another $5 billion or so sitting in the bank. They're not in trouble of going out of business or anything like that, and they're right. still making billions every quarter. That being said, it is to take a gamble on 60% of your standing money is really significant, and it tells me, even though I don't think I understand it, Patrick understands it, or anybody that I've been able to read stories on today really understands why they're doing it. Somebody at Intel, at least one person who has a lot of influence at Intel, believes that the acquisition of McAfee is vitally important to the future of the company. It's the only way that they would, you know, really go out of their way to make this kind of investment. It's helpful when you buy a company that's profitable already and you don't have to worry about keeping them afloat while you figure out how to integrate them with what you're doing. That's definitely true. But for a company that makes this much money, they're not really worried about, you know, McAfee saving their bottom line or anything. There were a couple of interesting topics that came up. Somebody pointed out, Alan actually, who works at PC Perspective, pointed out that you know, McAfee doesn't just sell to retail consumers. Chances are that's a very small portion of their income. What they do sell is dedicated hardware that sits in data centers and office buildings and that kind of stuff that monitors traffic, that does a lot of security firewall type activities and that type of thing. And I don't know if maybe that would have more to do with Intel's integration with this or not. I mean, still, to me, it seems kind of outside the bounds. It's not like you see Intel going out and buying rack space or going out and buying, other kind of architecture or companies that use their architecture and specific hardware designs or anything like that either. So it's still kind of questionable. Have you read anything else about what it could possibly be they wanted other than, I don't know. I mean, are they going to start integrating security software of some type directly in the hardware, and why would they need? It just seems odd to me. If Intel wanted to do that, the industry leader, they could just do that. And McAfee and Norton and Microsoft Security Essentials sounds to me like they would all just kind of follow in long, right? Oh, Intel's integrating this feature in hardware. We should support that. Why they would need to buy one of those software companies in order to try to get anything like that rolling is a little bit surprising to me. Oh, Patrick, are you on mute?
Sorry about that. One, it's making like 80% profit on $2 billion in revenue. So it's an earner, right? So in that sense, it probably keeps a lot of skeptics from being too angry about it. But two, I think it's going to do with integrating security features, probably based on research and technology that McAfee has available and using it to the advantage of Intel processors. I think it's going to be really interesting to see what they do with it, if anything at all, because it does, everybody, you were talking about it before, we were all looking at it going, this is so peculiar.
Mm-hmm.
So
now, there are a lot of people in the chat room joking around saying CPUs, they're going to make CPUs that are slower because they have McAfee antivirus running all the time out of the box. And, you know, from a consumer standpoint, that's what we know about McAfee, right? Is it comes pre-installed on your laptop or your desktop, and it's one of those first things that you maybe uninstall and you reinstall something else like AVG or Avast or, you know, something. Even Microsoft Security Essentials runs a lot lighter, I think, on your system than anything they have. There was an interesting editorial over at Tech Report, which is another great hardware website, that Scott Wasson, the owner of that, kind of questions what Intel might do about that in the consumer side, right? So there's two options. One, Intel continues to push, or McAfee continues to push out, you know, we're going to give a lot of money to get our systems or get our software installed on Dell systems and Toshiba systems, that kind of thing. And that's actually where they ended up making a lot of their money. McAfee was people actually purchasing the software after their trials are up, right? That's the average consumer would probably do. But there are issues now. We talked about the FTC and Intel being in trouble for monopolistic practices. And now if Intel buys McAfee and they have a potential monopoly on pre-installed security software on computers, it seems like they might be opening themselves up to a little bit more a complicated issue in that realm. not sure, but
I don't know what to say. It's a bizarre, I think all around, it's a peculiar, unexpected kind of bizarre purchase, and I think we'll all be quite enthused to find out what it's all about.
But I like to believe what I want to believe is that Intel purchased this company for $7.6 billion expressly to prevent them from putting bloatware on computers that you buy from now on, because they were tired of it making their systems or systems powered by Intel processors slower. So maybe there'll be a rule. If you get an Intel system, you can't put McAfee on it. 7.6 billion to kill speed. It all. So
crazy.
Interesting. Another topic. Actually, before we get into, we're going to talk about an undead graphics card. And if you don't know what that means, we'll explain that in just a second. But first, I do want to talk about our friends at Carbonite Pro, who is the sponsor of today's episode of This Week in Computer Hardware. Now, business PCs crash all the time, even if you have software on like McAfee or... We're saying that, right? McAfee? Sometimes people say McAfee, whatever it is.
McAfee works.
There you go. So the business PCs are crashing all the time. It could be because of hard drives, could be of viruses, because employees are less selective about what they download on your PCs rather than their own. Be sure to keep your business up and running, even if your computers aren't, with Carbonite Pro. Carbonite Pro backs up all of your PCs in your business automatically whenever they're connected to the internet. It's safe. Your files are encrypted before they leave your computer for maximum security. It's easy to use whether you're a computer novice or a full-fledged techie. It's automatic. Carbonite backs up your files right away whenever you are online. It's affordable. Prices start at just $10 a month, and you only pay for the amount of backup that you actually need. And it's one account with one monthly bill. Carbonite Pro also gives you a centralized dashboard to give you or your administrator, if that doesn't happen to be you, a backup status summary for all your computers in the business. If there's ever a data loss problem, each employee can access their own backup files themselves. You could be notified and your office can be up and running again with no headaches or time lost. And because your files are backed up offsite, each person can access their own files from any computer or even on their iPhone or BlackBerry with the free applications. All this means you can focus on growing your business and leave the backup to Carbonite Pro. Now, if you want to try this out, all you have to do is go to carbonitepro.com. It's free for 30 days. And like I said before, prices start as low as $10 per month. And no special code needed for this, just carbonitepro.com. And we thank them for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of undead graphics cards, this is an interesting little story. BFG. I think most of us know who this company is. They were at one time the kind of preeminent partner of NVIDIA for graphics cards. They were the first to really start offering lifetime warranties, first to offer 24/7 support. They were really kind of like the North American marketing arm at like Best Buys and Fry's and that type of stuff. If you went into a Best Buy from 2004 to 2006 or 2003 to 2006, if you wanted a video card, it was going to be a BFG card. They had great relationships with those guys as well. Unfortunately, as has happened in the last year or so, BFG slowly kind of started just to fall off on the charts, and eventually they decided they were going to close their graphics card business altogether. What's interesting is that we got a hold of some pictures of a graphics card that was hopefully going to be the savior for BFG, or one of the cards that was going to be a savior for BFG, but it never ended up happening. This is a BFG Radeon HD 5750 that we actually have pictures of the box and of the card itself. So what's interesting about this is BFG never actually had an agreement with AMD. They were trying to get an agreement with AMD to become an ATI Radeon graphics card vendor and reseller. They had these cards made through a Chinese company just to kind of show, hey, we can do this. Hey, we can create a good branding scheme. We can create good products. We still have our good warranty behind us, all this other kind of stuff.
Right.
And it's interesting that it just never happened. Just didn't get off the ground. So it was kind of an interesting little moratorium, I guess. That's not the right word, but look back at what could have been on this card. So I not much else to it other than that. I mean, you knew of BFG, obviously, being in the hardware world as well. I think it would have been a shock to see BFG ATI graphics cards ever come out on the market.
Yeah, it would have been a little unusual or against type. I don't know. It's also been interesting watching the card vendors, graphics vendors, kind of consolidate over the last couple of years, or at least it feels that way, that they're kind of smirching together smaller units to make faster stuff or how to renovate an existing unit or when it thinks in terms of a design. I don't know. It's a little peculiar. Are you sad about this, Ryan? Are you going to miss him?
Most of the people that I knew at BFG have already moved on to other companies. I'm sad that the company is gone because it was the edgy company, right? Before it was cool to be edgy. You know, if you know what BFG stands for, it's kind of a gutsy thing to call their company BFG. They were really built on a gaming base, right? The people that started the company were gamers. They really started in the high-end world doing water cooling graphics cards and those kind of stuff before they eventually moved into the low-end cards to sell to Best Buy and that kind of stuff.
Basically, you're saying the magic is gone.
The magic is gone just as a whole in this for this company and for a lot of this industry as well. You know, you look at XFX. That's the company that you would compare to this. XFX was a dedicated NVIDIA partner at one point, and they made the move over to ATI. They actually offer both, but I think it's fair to say that NVIDIA is a little bit more vindictive than most companies when it comes to this kind of stuff. So when you start offering ATI graphics cards and all these dealings, I'm told, were done behind the scenes and they didn't really know what was going to happen, you probably get your allocation cut. And they find reasons to do that and this kind of stuff. So maybe they're not on as good of terms with NVIDIA anymore, but they're okay with what they're selling in the ATI market, right? That's obviously a risk these companies had to take. It was interesting that BFG looked like they were willing to take this risk as well. And this is the time when the Radeon 5000 series is by far the best option out there when all this was going on, right? It was still the 200s from NVIDIA and the 5000 series from ATI that had a big advantage in price, performance, power efficiency, all kinds of stuff. So just an interesting look down what could have happened but never actually did.
Speaking of looking down maps.
Yes, roadmaps in this case.
Apparently, Engadget got a hold of Engadget of we're the only one who's ever seen it in iTunes kind of fame. Scored, I quote, an Intel roadmap with details of Sandy Bridge CPUs and expands the SSD lineup. So SSDs, the idea is Q1, bigger SSDs, faster SSDs, and oh yes, there's a really interesting disconnect between what's going on. Not disconnect. I was expecting some of the SSD drive updates to come before holiday shopping season, rather than sort of into 2011. Right. But basically, more drives, faster drives, bigger drives, and more CPUs too.
Yeah, the CPU news is not really that interesting in these slides that I saw. They talk a little bit about specs, not a whole lot. They talk about the model numbering system. It's going to be more complex than it already is, so that's always good news. We're going to have four numbers instead of three numbers, and then a letter at the end. K for unlocked, S for low power, and T for really, really low power consumption. So that's how they're going to be binned and all that kind of stuff.
If the yellow box, the yellow box is the gaming version, which has the craptastic gaming software. I was thinking of like strange packaging practices based around that.
Yeah. Now for the SSDs, what's interesting is, so we've known that Intel is going to move to 25 nanometer NAND flash for, you know, about a year or so. Alan, our storage guy at PC Perspective, went out and toured the Intel fab, and they showed him, here, we're making 25 nanometer. It's going to be ramping up soon. For those of you who like SSDs, and I think most of us do, Intel is still one of our favorite brands, and you're limited right now to 160 gigabyte SSD if you want to do the X25M, which is the mainstream, the consumer one, the one that we recommend to everybody. It's the MLC drives. They're saying in Q4 of 2010, which might be able to get out for the holiday season, but not, I mean, I'm not going to count on it. They're going to have 160, 300, and 600 gigabyte SSDs, which would be fantastic in my book if we also get some much improved scaling and price per gigabyte with the move from, you know, down to the 25 nanometer flash.
Gotta ask for everything, don't you, Ryan?
I want more, I want faster, and I want it cheaper. And I think in the computer world, we should be able to get that. That's how technology scales, really.
They're so innocent.
Yeah, I know. So the chances are good that you, before Christmas, you might be able to buy a 600 gig Intel SSD and be very happy with it, I think. So the only other interesting note here in the SSD roadmap really is the enterprise class X25E drives that are still today limited to 64 gigabytes. They're the SLC. This is the single channel flash that has write speeds that are higher than the mainstream drives. It also has a higher lifespan or something like that. You know, we don't worry about lifespan really in the mainstream drives, but in the enterprise, they might worry about that kind of stuff. The Q1 2011 update that you were mentioning there, the 400 gig, up to 400 gigs for enterprise levels, those are using MLC memory now. So they're not using single channel, they're using multi-layer, which is interesting. Because either Intel has said, well, we really can't produce SLC at this capacity, at this level, 25 nanometer at this size, or they can't make it, you know, fast enough, or, you know, something like that. Or they've increased the reliability of MLC to a point where they're comfortable offering this to their enterprise customers. So it'll be interesting to see what they talk about. It's possible that next month I'll be out in your direction, well, where you're normally at, not where you're at today. For the Intel Developer Forum in September in downtown San Francisco. Hopefully they'll be talking a little bit more about all of these
things. They usually do. All next year's products. Open. Shenanigans. I love this one. Shenanigans on Super Saddest Claimed Audio Qualities.
I thought you'd like this story. That's why I put it in there.
I love this story.
Yeah. It's
so ahead. Malcolm Stewart, right, we'll call him an audiophile journalist, an audio systems journalist. He's into that whole concept. He claims that some SATA cables can improve the sound quality of music. The same cable, you know, is carrying zeros and ones, but his make them crisper and more robust. And so it's like he had a pee on the carpet or something. But it's really funny. He's like, I listen to the cables, my NAS feeding my Haim HDX and my apologies, Haim or Haim, if I get your name wrong, HDX, XPS, and clearly identified easily perceptible problems. And he goes on and on and on, and basically, my only guess is that the Super SATAs reject interference significantly better than the standard cable, and in so doing, reduce the noise floor, revealing greater low-level musical detail and greater low-level music. I wish I'd found that like 3 years ago, but... Yeah, it's just basically the guy saying, when I listen to zeros and ones move over this expensive cable, it sounds amazing unlike that other cable over there. And I'm with the skeptics that don't buy into him, you know. There's zeros and ones. They're traveling over the copper. Zeros and ones. It doesn't matter, you know. It's as long as the zero and the one gets to the audio card, we're good. You know what I mean?
This story makes me want to cry, Patrick. It really does.
This invalidates the entire concept of lab testing to find the perfect product. This is a jackass plugging his cable into a hard drive and going, oh my goodness, it really opens up the sound stage. You know what I mean? And it's like, okay, I've had epiphanal moments. You know, I own some expensive interconnect cables.
Yeah.
Because I took them home and I did hear a difference. Mostly I've decided because it got the crufty old beat up, ratted out, straight from the zip wire rack at Home Depot cables that had been semi-soldered by someone previously and were connecting my really nice pre-amplifier, my really nice amplifier. But yeah, so the zeros and ones sound better. Oh, wait, it gets even worse. Because I want to read a quote because somebody really nailed it.
Okay.
Hold on. Where is it? He describes the technology. Okay, brace yourself. Get the camera on Ryan. I want to watch his face. No. This is going to be great. Everybody look in the mirror if you are an engineer at home. This is from – it's Malcolm Stewart, malcolmstewart.co.uk. As you can see, the cables do not look anything special, even though they are far more robust than the standard issue flat cables, and they are irradiated, I am told, to vaporize any moisture that has found its way into the molecular structure of the conductors. So let me see if we get this right. They are irradiated to remove the moisture from copper. I'm no physicist, but I'm not buying this one.
The part that makes me sad is somebody's going to read this and they're going to go, damn, I never knew that. And they're going to believe this because there's nobody behind them to smack them in the back of the head and say that's not right. Or they just don't know any better. But when you see, I mean, I know we're ripping this article apart. The most marked and worthwhile difference I felt was in the increased naturalness in both the sound of instruments and voices, which seemed more organic, human, and less electronic. And it goes on and on. And the best part about this, by the way, is this is a NAS. So his static, his magic SATA cable is going from the hard drive to the NAS box and then over several feet at least of networking cable. So the networking cable must also be magic.
I don't know. Like, I have a love-hate relationship with high-end audio because every so often I have one of those where somebody is basically knitted, you know, basically like, you know, here at Kitty Audio, we basically maintain a herd of Persian cats out of whose freshly shedded and only on silk fur we mat into custom, you know what I mean? Like, imagine like somebody so weird that went, you know, I think a speaker cone made out of cat fur felt would be the perfect way to, you know, whatever, open up the sound stage. So they make their cat fur felt speakers. And once in a while, somebody does something like that and it sounds amazing. Or, you know, the Melos, you know, Shah, was a headphone amplifier. That was a fantastic headphone amplifier, even though it had a tube in it. I mentioned that because Lloyd Case has got me on a sort of a I hate tubes kick, but I don't want to get into that one right now. But I bring that up because listening to a really nice set of headphones on this particular amplifier completely redefined the idea of the level of audio quality that could come out of a set of headphones. And I've walked into somebody's room where they have this painstakingly assembled, you know, machine, and they've thrown on an orchestra, and it's like being in the fifth row, and it's perfection, and it's huge, and it fills the room, and all of a sudden phrases like, you know, airy and airspace and stage, like the sound stage is wide, suddenly makes sense. But the problem is in the entire high-end audio industry, there's a lot of, you know, people with a lot of money that are looking for different, you know, ways to differentiate their systems. And the end result is you get people creating these weird little devices based on what I'll call pseudo physics, because they have little or no basis in reality. And the placebo effect kicks in. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like, ooh, my goodness. Ryan, I noticed you use the irradiated cable to connect your camera to your PC. you look more vivid and detailed. Your colors are sharper. That's just fantastic. You know, it's audio cables. Okay, I'll buy once in a while. You hear something that maybe sounds a little better, mostly because you're going from crappy, rotted out, crusty copper. You know, because the electrons, the energy kind of moves on the outside of the copper, you know, the copper itself. It's kind of an interesting concept. So putting 29,000 strands in a much bigger and lowering the resistance because you've basically thrown more copper at the problem, I can see maybe possibly having – okay, I have had experiences where it made a difference, partially because I think because I cleaned all the cruft off of the amplifier inputs and the preamp outputs. But
sure.
Yeah, the whole idea that your zeros and ones are going to sound –
how about an analog signal there?
I mean, is your processor sitting there going like, this is artful arrangements of the binary feeds me. My goodness, I will churn out a better decode. I mean, it's just – sorry, I've ranted far too long on this. Yeah, good pick, man. It's just
I love seeing stories like that. It's like Denon, D-E-N-O-N, the high-end amplifier manufacturer. They make good quality products. They did sell a $450 network cable a couple of years ago. So, you know,
sometimes
you got that going for you as well.
The question is did they sell a lot of them? It's like I'm the first one. Like first one to bag on. I because it was the only example of this very obscure socket. I needed to work with a socket, like a 220 volt laundry socket. I actually own a pastel colored. Gold plated, you know, probably oxygen free copper dryer plug from Monster Cable.
Yeah. Nice.
And I was horrified and embarrassed to be, you know, purchasing it because I got this sort of pitying look from a group of like serious. Mm-hmm. It was in a Fry's and these like serious audio nerds are talking about something in the corner and they see me pick up this cable and they're all kind of like, ew.
Yeah, you know, Monster Cables do tend to answer that as well. So, oh well.
My goodness. In any case, the zeros and ones impacting the end audio quality. I'm not buying into. Not even.
I'm not either, and I don't think anybody listening to this should either. I think it's a good story for us to end on to move on to our section of Twitter questions, user inputs. If you want to submit a question to Patrick or I for the show, not for today's show, obviously you're already listening to it, but for next week's show, you can follow Patrick. He is at Patrick Norton on Twitter, and I am at Ryan Shrout. We both made it pretty easy on you guys. So
if you can't find us, you didn't type in our names. Maybe the wrong variation on our names. In any case.
Yep.
Oh, A. Fritz at Ryan Shrout. I need a new games drive. I've got a 150 gigabyte Raptor now. Money not an issue. Get 7200 1 terabyte or 600 gigabyte Velociraptor only for games. So is this only on a gaming system or is this the hard drive inside the gaming system where he stores his games?
It sounds like both. Like he has a computer and he wants to store his games on. He only wants one hard drive, but all he really does on his computer is game. He doesn't really worry about anything else for that matter.
I just can't, I can't look at a question like this, even though it's complete overkill. I just want to say like buy an SSD.
The problem with an SSD, and I've run into the same thing, is that when you have a lot of games, 160 gigs goes by real quick, which I'm guessing is his problem with his 150 gig Raptor that he has today.
But money is not an issue. He could just buy lots of expensive drives.
That's true. That's true. If money is really not an issue, then you can get, you know, three RAID 0 160 gig hard drives or 120 gig or 250 gig SSDs, you know, something like that. It's going to cost you a lot of money, especially when you look at it price per gig. Now, if you take the SSD out of the picture and you just look at a 7200 terabyte or larger drive or
probably
a 600
black
gig
or the performance version of the 1 terabyte drive.
Yep. Or the 600 gig Velociraptor.
You'll load levels faster, right?
Yes. Yes. I mean,
how much faster?
The 600 gig Velociraptor is the fastest standard spindle based hard drive that, for the consumer that you can buy. That much I can say for 100%. without a doubt. It can be notably faster on random reads, but not necessarily as much faster on sustained reads, which is the majority of what a game loading actually is, right? I mean, random reads would be if you're opening up a bunch of different files that are located in different spots on the hard drive. Chances are when you're loading in a map file, it's a single, 500 meg file or whatever it is, something like that. And in that case, the speed differences between a high capacity 7200 RPM drive and the 600 gig Velociraptor is going to be probably difficult to tell. The Velociraptor will still be faster, but it will be a smaller difference. My recommendation would
be three times as much for it.
Right. So a 600 gig Velociraptor is going to be about $250 today, which is high for standard spindle-based hard drive.
I saw a bunch of listings for like $290 to $300 for it. I haven't found anything that cheap yet. Yeah.
So they're up there. Meanwhile, you can get a 1 terabyte drive for $100, even the black, like a Caviar Black from Western Digital or whatever the high performance brands are from Seagate and those guys as well. And you can get a 2 terabyte for under the price of, I think you can get 2 terabytes for like $175, I want to say, I mean, still relatively cheap compared to what the Velociraptor is going to cost you. And obviously you get the benefits of added capacity as well down the road. You'll be able to play a lot more games on 2 terabytes than you can on 600 gigs.
Trying to look up the price on some of the hard drives on Newegg.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, if I don't want to really recommend something super expensive, even if money's no object, for game loading time, because it's not going to make a huge difference. We have a video editing machine here where we have 3 600 gig Velociraptor hard drives set up in a RAID 5 array. So we get 1.2 terabytes of capacity and we get much, much improved performance because we're using 3 Velociraptor drives on a high-end RAID card. So that's, if you wanted the absolute best, that's what you'd get. But I think when he says money not an issue, I think he means I'm not worried about spending $200 versus $300, but I don't want to spend $1,000, which I think is totally, totally reasonable for this type of thing. So
good call.
Next question.
I was going to say a lot of cheap hard drives up on Newegg.
Oh, tons.
2 terabyte Western Digital Caviar Green, $120. Yep. 500 gigabyte notebook drives, $59.99, $60.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Storage is one of those things that's just so cheap now. It's just like, at this point, how many SATA ports do I have and how many bays do I have in my case to put hard drives? Because for $100, $120 bucks, I can add 2 more terabytes in. RAID 5 arrays make a lot more sense now. We got another question here from I Am Waits. Says Ryan Schramm, Patrick Norton, Core i5 430M, 450M, or 530M for a laptop, are the price increases worth it? Now, I'm going to be honest with you. I didn't even look this up. In terms of clock frequencies and this kind of stuff, or the price increases. But the fact that he's asking me tells me that chances are they're not worth it. I mean, unless you're doing something really heavy on the run, a Core i5 430M is still
like a 2.8 gigahertz processor, right?
Yeah. And when you take into account turbo frequencies and all this kind of stuff, you've got a dual core hyper-threaded, so you're running 4 threads on this notebook processor. The performance boost you get from it is probably not worth it. And this is different than what I would say for desktop machines, because with desktop machines, I tend to go with the side of get something in the middle, and then you can push up a little bit further. You can't really do that with notebooks. But for my own notebook purchases, what I tend to do with is what's the cheapest and then go one step over it, so I don't feel like I'm buying the worst product in that line. Even though if it's not a bad product, I don't feel like I bought the cheapest one. I'm a hardware guy. I can't do that. Let me go, what's the next little bump up? And I don't ever buy memory from, Lenovo or Dell or anything like that. Apple. Yeah, especially.
Well, I was going to say, unless you're, you know, like a video editor or a performance enthusiast or a gamer, in which case you may want to actually, since for all intents and purposes, outside of the hard drive and the memory, it's hard to upgrade a notebook very much in some ways. You might want to like spring for the fastest processor you can, so it has the sort of longest perceived legs against the other processors out there. That's one of the things I'm running into a lot of places where people are like, well, should I upgrade it? Should I not upgrade it?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Most frequent questions we get for
you
sure.
You can't really upgrade notebooks. So, you know, check the benchmarks. Take a look at the benchmarks of the 430 versus the previous generation, basically Core 2 Duo. And at that point, I think you can make a much more intelligent decision. Use the benchmarks, people.
All right. We have another question coming in from Alex Hackney. In case you're wondering, this is actually two tweets that I cut into it. If you thought you got a way to get past the 140 characters, it says, I use a video editing computer every day. I do not game on it. I just edit and stream video with it. It is a Core 2 Quad 6600, has a Western Digital 10,000 RPM hard drive. Doesn't say what capacity really. 4 gigs of DDR2 memory and a GeForce 8800 GS graphics card. What specific upgrade would you recommend for better HD video editing, or is it a complete upgrade time? Don't have a dedicated scratch disk.
You gotta tell us what application you're running in a situation like this, because so much of what you can do to accelerate different applications, like video editing, does this affect, you know, take advantage of acceleration in the graphics card, you know?
Right.
Is there one online in the near future? What's going on in terms of, you know, what size files you're working with, right? 4 gigabytes, you know, maybe more than enough memory if you work with little teeny tiny short films, but having additional memory capacity on a Core i7 system could make a huge difference in terms of day-to-day use of the system for editing video, right? Because video is an incredibly demanding thing to do in terms of editing video on a computer. And to scale it down on a notebook, it can really make a pretty huge impact. That said, if you look at the benchmarks and, you know, okay, so is there a big difference between the processor, like, you know, the next generation processor and the existing generation processor? You probably can't get more. You're not going to get more memory on that system, which may be the most useful thing you can do for working with large video files. You know, you could get a dedicated scratch disk, you know, using an SSD. You could replace the Western Digital 10. You know, kilohertz, 10K hard drive with, you know, something like an Intel X25M.
Yep.
But without knowing which application you use and whether or not it takes advantage of certain features inside of graphics cards or other places, it's hard to give the detailed and finite answer that we'd like to. Because in some cases, it's really easy to figure out what you can turn on in a given application. Right. Or like what plugins you could download or what particular elements of, because, you know, video editing is this big, huge collection of code from all these different sources.
Yeah,
and some of those things take advantage of the graphics card. Some of them don't. So you kind of need to do that homework first.
Yeah. Like, for example, we use Adobe Premiere Pro CS5 here as support for GPU acceleration on the decoding process. So we it uses the GPU to decode the HD stream so we can kind of edit multiple 1080p streams at the same time, which has been very useful for us. It also supports GPU encoding for when you're exporting your project out. If you're using that, then, you know, you might want to look at what graphics cards are supported by NVIDIA and Adobe in that configuration. I think you can get it like a GeForce GTX 285 and it will actually support it. 4 gigs of memory is, if you're doing HD video, could be a bottleneck. Your storage, I mean, the thing is, as Patrick said, all of these could be a bottleneck. And I think upgrading any of them at this point would get you a performance boost. That being said, if I were looking at this list and I had to pick one, I would probably. So if you change your processor, you're going to have to go Core i7s. You're going to need a new motherboard, DDR3 memory anyway. So you're basically getting your complete upgrade time almost at that point. So I would say go to 8 gigs of memory and see if you see a benefit. And if not, I don't know. I hope you can sell that memory as you upgrade the rest of your system to a DDR3 build. So there you go.
the right match at Ryan Shroud. If I went Crossfire with two different brands of 5750s, would I run into any major problems? Oh boy.
This is actually an easy one. The answer is no. Right. If they're the same GPU, if they're both 5750s, you won't run into any major problems. The only issue that might crop up is if one of them is overclocked and one of them isn't, then they'll both run at the lower speed. They'll both run at effectively the lower speed. So you think of when you add in a second card for Crossfire or SLI, the best you can theoretically run at is two times the lowest common denominator. So that's the best you can do is two times as fast as the slowest graphics card in that configuration. Now, you're not really going to even come close to that. You might get 60-70% of the slowest graphics card in additional performance. But just because they're different brands doesn't matter. When Crossfire and SLI first started, that was an issue. You had to have two identical cards. They had to have the same from the same vendor. They had to have the same VGA BIOS on it. They had to have all. There were all kinds of really.
You basically had to buy two cards at the same time from the same vendor, pretty much on the same week, to get it to do what you wanted it to do.
Which really defeats the purpose of the upgradability of what it did. But now that's all better, both on NVIDIA and AMD side. As long as you get the same GPU. And you don't have to have the same frame buffer size, but you really should, because then you're just throwing away whatever extra purchase you had. But if you happen to maybe find one sitting around, you can use that as well.
Stewie Ross, why is it better to reinstall Windows on a new SSD rather than clone? The cynic in me says to make performance gains seem greater. Twitter English can be strange sometimes. Merit? Question mark. Cruft. Bit rot. Basically, over time, as you install applications, as internet applications do weird things in the background of your computer, as data gets moved around the hard drive, as electrons from the sun zip through the surface of the platter. I'm exaggerating, people. Don't explain physics to me on this one. Over time, Windows gets nasty. We call it bit rot. Bit rot can be modest, bit rot can be severe, but it just generally sort of over time, the sort of like knitted code that makes up Windows gets chewed on and looks a little moth-eaten. So a fresh install takes care of that. Even better, if you build the perfect installation for your computer to clone it then, and then you can sort of put that perfected version on there. The reason it's better to reinstall Windows rather than clone it is because you get rid of all the nasty excess code and you start over with a nice fresh package.
Yeah, it's always better to do that. I think it's funny that he mentions this in this way, because if you format your system and install Windows fresh, it's going to seem faster.
Right.
For the exact reason.
Especially
you
after
mentioned.
A couple of weeks.
Yeah,
and over time, as it basically optimizes itself to the way you use your computer, it will speed up your day-to-day usage of the computer. Will continue to speed up over time. So, at least for
and
a while.
Obviously, what he's saying is, I wonder if most of this SSD performance boost is because people format their machines and they go from something that's been very slow to very fast all of a sudden, and they get benefits. Don't be cynical about that, Stewie Ross. SSDs do make a difference in performance. The MacBook that's sitting here was never reinstalled fresh. It was a clone from the existing hard drive on here onto it, put it back in, and it's never been done. You know, had a format and restart, and it's still. You know, you still get the application start time, performance benefits, and all that kind of stuff. No need to be cynical about that. that's something I can be sure of. So that's it. That's our last Twitter question for this evening. That's gonna be this week in computer hardware, as we all like to say. Now, Patrick, I know right now you're out in the middle of nowhere, but if people wanted to find you on a more regular basis, where should they look?
Not quite nowhere. I'm just in the sticks, man, up by Thunder Ranch. Normally, you can find me at Techzilla, TechZilla.com, or HDNation.tv. One of them is a fun, feisty show about computer products and technology and making them behave for you. The other one is HDNation, which is all about high-definition content and home theater gear. Please, HDNation.tv is the website. I ask you all politely to come out and visit.
Oh, yeah. And thank you to Robert for filling in for me last week on last minute notice. I really appreciate that. Sounds like you guys did a good job. So if you want to find me, I am at PC Perspective, PCper.com. That's a website I run and operate on a daily basis, almost every day. Sometimes I take a day off. I would look at hardware reviews, do video reviews and that kind of stuff as well on CPUs, graphics cards, motherboards, all kinds of things. And every once in a while, we do fun stuff like throw hardware workshops at QuakeCon and give away thousands and thousands of dollars worth of stuff. So, and again, Patrick is at Patrick Norton on Twitter, at Ryan Shrout for me. And we like to quiz you guys usually in the Thursday afternoon time frame to start getting questions ready for the shows. And if you don't watch us live, you definitely should. It's probably more fun, more interesting. You get to go, I mean, like today, you got to see the day-night cycle as Patrick Norton went from full bright sun into the darkest dark we've ever seen on the show.
You know what? It's the sun is set enough so that it's no longer blowing out the camera into a white pearly mess.
You can watch us every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific at live.twit.tv. And that's going to be it for this week at Computer Hardware. We'll talk to you next week.